Howdy-do, buckaroos. Welcome to the Mac Observer's Daily Observations Podcast. It is Monday, January 28th, 2019. I am your host, Kelly Gamont. With me today, I have Brian Chaffin. Hi, Brian.
Hello. It's good to be here.
Also with me today, I'm Charlotte Henry. Hi, Charlotte.
I don't really know how to follow that, but hello, good afternoon. How nice to speak to you both.
No one does, I assure you.
It is a frequent refrain.
Yes, this is a thing that does happen regularly.
I said it's either a very high bar or a very low bar. probably depends upon the listener.
And the answer is yes.
The answer is yes. Yes.
So today for our first topic, I want to talk a little bit about social media, particularly in Charlotte's neck of the woods.
Yes.
Because it could all go away at any moment.
Well, so let's roll back a bit. The Health Secretary, Matt Hancock, who is previously, was actually the digital minister and then the digital secretary of state. He's involved in this stuff. He even released his own app under his own name, which is a whole different story. This is a relatively digitally savvy guy.
Okay.
He was talking to one of the leading politics Sunday morning chat shows. And said that, you know, if social media companies are refusing to do things that they need to do, the British Parliament and government could legislate to force them. This is specifically about material related to self-harm and suicide, because there was an awful case in 2017 of a 17-year-old girl called Molly Russell who took her own life having looked at that kind of content. Mm-hmm. Her family blamed Instagram and Pinterest, it seems, in particular. And so Matt Hancock said, you know, the companies have got to do something about it. If they don't, we are going to pass some laws. And then the next question was basically, and if they still don't do that, could you ban them? To which his answer was, in theory, yes, Parliament does have the right to sanction them. But he said, it's not where I'd like to end up. Which... No.
Well, I would jump in there and say that, you know, be prepared to be voted out of office for doing that because people love their social media.
Right.
I mean, so, that's why it's a problem in the first place. Mm-hmm, so sure. Like no politician is going to risk doing that. So that is a very, very, very hollow threat.
I would. Yeah. And also just knowing the kind of genuinely quite pro technology politician that this specific guy is, I'd be surprised if that's the case. I think the point he is making, which is not an unfair one, and it's something we've discussed on this show a number of times, is that these social media companies are not above the law. They are not free of constraints. They do not operate in a post-legislative era, if you like. And I think politicians are now really starting to try and track down on that. And that's fair enough. This particular case that has triggered all this in the UK is pretty horrendous. And it's often one of these things where it becomes, you know, a story tied to an individual that kind of triggers a change in thinking. Now, of course, there's all sorts of other issues with this, that, for example, there is lots of information out there that helps people deal with anxiety and suicide and self-harm feelings and can maybe make them feel better and give them information about where to go and so on. So there's a very, very fine line mm-hmm. about the type of information you want to go. You obviously do not want to be in a situation where you're stopping people, for example, getting support. So I think this is a particularly tricky issue, and it's another one that the social media companies are going to have to step up on, because they were under pressure at the end of last year, as we know, over things like fake news, over disruption in politics and so on. And now this seems to be the next thing.
So let me take another step up to, I don't know, 10,000-15,000 feet, something like that. And at the root of this issue, so there's a huge, there's two things I want to say. The first is that there is a huge difference between the UK and the US. The UK tends to be more proactive in protecting consumer rights, but at the same time, the UK is much more aggressive in terms of the surveillance state. You guys have so many cameras in London. I mean, it's Orwellian, the number of cameras you guys have in London. And
there's a lot of them.
There is a freaking lot of them. And there's also the state has a lot more power to be intrusive into people's lives than is currently the case here in the States. Although, you know, there's often some, you know, give and take there as to which, yeah, which country is going to be the most intrusive. But in addition, the separate issue is how the social media companies all felt like they could grow and have this near limitless amount of user-generated content with no one policing it. They said no one policing it, except most some algorithms, and that would be fine, and that there couldn't be any problem with that, and that they bore no responsibility, and as a matter of fact, they really needed to keep their hands off so that they wouldn't be responsible for any of it. And we're seeing the limits and foibles of that approach, and I think that is what is at the heart of what you're is he an MP? What is he?
Yes, of course. To be a member of the government at that level, to be a member of the government, you have.
Okay, I didn't even catch that he was in the government. I didn't know if he was a government.
Yeah, he's the health. It's the health secretary.
Okay. All right. So, I think that's probably at the heart of what he's talking about. There is that social media companies have long thought that they pretty much just bore no responsibility and should keep their hands off of stuff, and they should be these sort of neutral arbiters. And what we've seen happen is that it's not the cream that rises to the top; it's the scum at the bottom.
I'm sitting here nodding. Kind of very enthusiastically. I really agree with this. I think the social media companies I think we've said this on so many, Ken, for so many different issues. They have created a beast they can no longer control, haven't they? Mm-hmm. And this is just another example, but it's a really serious example because it seems to be costing people like 17-year-old Molly Russell their life. And yes, individuals have responsibility, but companies also have a huge amount of responsibility for the content that is allowed in their networks and their platforms, and how easy it is for young, vulnerable teenagers to get to it.
Then there's the flip side of all that. And the flip side of all that is that the government tends to not be adept enough to decide what speech is allowed and what speech is not allowed.
Correct.
Absolutely dangerous path to head down. And do we really want to be giving that same power to corporations? And I mean, but someone needs to have that power.
Right. And this is absolutely the dilemma, isn't it? Because I share your concerns that both a government and a private corporation having deciding what is acceptable speech and what is not, and what is acceptable for people to see and what is not.
Well, the reality is that the corporations do have, at least here in the States, I have zero idea how the UK looks at that, or let alone the EU, has more power to decide what is allowed on their platform than the government has to say what is allowed on their platform, right? You know, Apple, generally speaking, Apple wants to keep out porn from the App Store, it gets to. If Apple wants to keep out political stuff, it gets to. If Apple wants to only censor liberal or progressive or liberal or conservative news sources, it actually gets to.
Yep.
And
if it doesn't want InfoWars on, it gets to.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this is the dilemma. But I also think, it's interesting because I also shared, I did a piece today linking to Kara Swisher's column from Friday from the New York Times, in which she, in her inimitable style, rewrote Mark Zuckerberg's Wall Street Journal op-ed, mm-hmm. which is well worth a read as well. But she emphasized that kind of basically, these companies have created a beast they can no longer control. They have, like, they don't know how to. It's gone way beyond anything Mark Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sandberg and Jack Dorsey and whoever else you want to name can handle.
And those companies are, in general, especially with Facebook, I feel that this is definitely like feel. I don't have direct evidence of this, but they're happy to continue making a profit from that beast. Mm-hmm. Right. That's a huge part of this is that, you know, all those choices that Facebook has made, they were all done in, you know, Mark Zuckerberg and other Facebook executives have made noise about how their mission is to connect people. But their mission has been to connect people in order to profit from those connections.
Right.
And from that information. And they have been very happy to profit from it. And they are happy to continue profiting it despite. But regardless, or in spite of, despite of, whatever. Anyway, bygones. And they're just happy to keep profiting from it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's part of part of what is frustrating about this is sort of finding out that there's not, that people will come out and say, gosh, you know, gee willikers, that's really sad, and this is a thing that really ought to be addressed and someone ought to do something, but then nobody who is in the position to be that person to actually do something is actually doing anything.
Yeah. Like look at YouTube's crap with conspiracy theorist videos, right? YouTube wasn't trying to steer people towards that. The reality is that the engaging nature of conspiracy theories meant that people engaged more when they got to it, and the algorithm just naturally steered people towards it. But that's the thing, is that algorithms aren't good at making judgments. Mm-mm. And by aren't good, I mean they aren't capable of making judgments. And human beings need to be involved in these in these decisions.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's the same sort of thing that we see with a lot of other stuff when you leave it, you know, particularly when you leave it entirely to machines in order to sort of abdicate the responsibility, you know, like it was just the computers that did it. We didn't, you know, but there's more to it than that. And it's sort of frustrating to watch them try to make that work. So if this happens, Charlotte, we will miss you on Twitter.
On a serious point, I don't think the next step for this is there'll be some kind of great firewall of UK, and we won't have Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and Snapchat and those kind of things. There is no conceivable way that will happen. What I think might happen, first of all, remember the British Parliament is very annoyed at Facebook for the way the Mark Zuckerberg didn't turn up to the hearing I reported on for the Mac Observer. The British government is desperate to find anything else to do that isn't Brexit.
Mm-hmm.
And so, look, he said he's going to start the legislative process on this, what's called a white paper, which is kind of the beginning of proposed laws. And we might see something. I think what the government will at least do here in the UK is try and put more responsibility on the social media companies for the content that their users see. Mm-hmm. And I think that was what we'll see next.
I hope so. You know,
the social media companies would be, in my opinion, it would be very smart of them to start trying to get ahead of these issues.
Right.
Because are so not likely. Right. They are so not likely to appreciate whatever kind of government regulation is going to come through. And I don't think we as users are going to appreciate that kind of regulation either. So
it almost behooves them to do this themselves. And then when they're called in front of whatever governmental body, be like, but look, we did all this stuff so that this isn't going to be an issue anymore. Now you don't have to pass a law. Please don't pass a law. I would think that would be their approach.
Yeah. And just to be clear, we're talking about social media companies. But as well as this television interview, Matt Hancock did also write a letter to a number of tech companies. That included Apple.
Mm-hmm.
what he said in that letter, as a quote in the piece, it's appalling how easy it is to still access this content. He's talking about self-harm and suicide content online. I mean, no doubt about the harm this material can cause, especially for young people. So that letter went to all the major tech firms. So Apple isn't kind of separate from this, if you like. It's not right. One of those being like, we're Apple, we don't do social media.
Mm-hmm.
He's written to them as well, as I understand it.
Yeah. Well, because that's the portal that most people are using to view a lot of this stuff.
Indeed.
It's probably something with an Apple logo on it, regardless
Indeed.
Of the size or whether or not it has a cell plan. So, yeah, and I assume we will hear more about this, provided Charlotte still has access in the future. But we will definitely be talking about this more. Right now, we need to move on and talk a little bit about our sponsors. Our sponsor today is Capterra. Capterra is the leading free online resource that can help you find the best software solution for your business. There are over 700,000 reviews of products, and all of those reviews come from actual software users. And you can discover everything you need in a new tool from over 700 specific categories in order to make an informed decision. And this includes everything from project management or email marketing to something pretty specific like church management software. So no matter what kind of software your business needs, Capterra makes it very easy to discover the right solution and to discover the right solution fast. So that's capterra.com/TDO. You can go there for free today, and you can find the right tools to make 2019 the year for your business. That's capterra.com/TDO, CAPTERRA.com/TDO. Now, the other thing we want to talk about today is manufacturing. I know this sounds terribly exciting, but part of what's going on with Apple manufacturing is two different stories that sort of came out almost at the same time this morning. Brian, you want to tell us about that?
Sure. Andrew actually wrote the original link teaser to the New York Times piece. But basically, the New York Times had a piece looking at the at sort of an illustrative
illuminating piece.
No, thank you. One of the sort of like symbolic aspects of why it is that companies like Apple can't bring even, you know, certainly large scale, maybe not medium mm-hmm. scale, and probably not even small scale manufacturing back to the States. And their story was about a screw, and that it was a screw that held up the original Mac Pro, because apparently no one in the States could make that screw. Mm-hmm. And the reason why no one in the States could make that screw is because China was making them. And there's a couple of pieces, like, this is not just about the screw. It's about the broader picture. And the story brought up two things, one of which we've talked about over the years on multiple occasions. Let's see here. Here's a quote from the New York Times. This is from Susan Helper, mm-hmm. an economics professor at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland. And she's also the former chief economist at the Commerce Department. She said, quote, China's not cheap. It's a place where, because it's an authoritarian government, you can marshal 100,000 people to work all night for you. That has become an essential part of the product rollout strategy. They talk about the fact that some of these manufacturing facilities where Apple is making its products or having its products made for it are miles long and might be employing hundreds of thousands of people. Now, I would like anyone who knows anything whatsoever about population in the United States to tell me where it is that Apple could put a factory and employ hundreds of thousands of people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not happening in the UK. It's not happening in Europe. It's not happening in the States. It can and does happen in China. And then, of course, another point that I've made many times is that working conditions, the kinds of hours, like, you know, Apple exceeds local regulations in terms of pay, in terms of safety, in terms of chemical exposure, in terms of work hours, in terms of overtime, right? Apple mm-hmm. is not scraping the bottom of the barrel when it comes to working conditions in China. Apple's actually leading the pack. But the point is that the kinds of hours that employees can work or have to work if they want the job are the kinds of hours that many people listening to the show had ancestors who fought and died for the right to not have to work those kinds of hours.
Mm-hmm.
And in other words, labor laws here are much more protective of workers, even if they're being eroded as we speak, than anything that happens in China. Like, the issue in China is not how cheap the labor is, it's how plentiful the labor is and increasingly how skilled the labor is. There's another piece in here, another quote in here. Let me find it because I think it this is not anything I'd ever talked about. It's not anything I'd ever heard about.
Well, as a spectator, I can say that at least one piece of this is it sort of seems like now, anyway, everything's made in China because everything's made in China.
To a certain extent. Now, at one point, nothing was made in China.
Right.
So clearly that sort of thing can change.
Mm-hmm.
But when nothing was made in China, companies weren't selling, you know, 80 million
on a scale
iPhones
that,
a year.
That they are now. Yeah.
Right. You know, the kind of precision stuff that's necessary for something like an iPhone or a top Samsung piece, et cetera. So here's something that Tim Cook said in China at a conference in late 2017. He said, "The skill here is just incredible." This is a quote. He said, "In the U.S., you could have a meeting of tooling engineers, and I'm not sure we could fill the room. In China, you could fill multiple football fields." Mm-hmm. Right? So this isn't just the workers. It's not just the fingers and the hands. It is also the engineering skills that can oftentimes turn on a dime. Like, and this thing with the screw is that, like, they had a company that could make them, and the dude was like driving like 1,000 screws to Apple an hour away in his Lexus, the guy that owned the company.
Uh-huh.
And I mean, and like, Apple can't make Mac Pros because it didn't have these screws.
Yeah.
And in the end, they ended up ordering those screws from China. And it's just, it is. Like, I have often said that Apple won't bring manufacturing back to the States until it could do it with robots. Mm-hmm. But to a certain extent, there's so much of the supply chain that also would have to be done in the States to make that viable and reasonable, that is an additional further impediment to this.
Yeah.
And it's really, really interesting. This Times piece, a lot of people are focusing on the screw. Mm-hmm. But it's not the screw. It's what the screw represents.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. They have a specific example of something to illustrate a far larger issue with making this stuff happen in the United States. And I think we're going to end up talking a little bit more about that tomorrow, because Apple came out and talked a little bit about the kind of job creation they do have here and what kind of stuff people are doing here. So I think
Apple, I know that we need to go.
Yes.
But this needs to be said too. Apple has been investing in U.S. manufacturing.
Yes.
There are currently parts that are made in the U.S. and shipped over to China for assembly.
Mm-hmm.
And Apple's advanced technology manufacturing. They've got a fund specifically designed to invest in U.S. companies that can do advanced manufacturing techniques. So Apple is trying to address some of this here in the States, but it can't actually just be Apple or even all the big corporations that can fix this. We actually need like government organized retraining. And even still, at the end of the day, again, we're not going to have a factory with hundreds of thousands of people in it. Not going to happen.
Correct. And I'm sure we'll hear more about this as we get more information on that sort of stuff, just because. But part of that is also, I just wish they'd put the manufacturing stuff in, because I think it's really interesting. Like, watching the videos of how they make the Mac Pro with all the robotics, I think it's pretty nifty. Yeah, Charlotte.
Can I just throw in a question? Now, both our countries have automobile industries that have kind of been hugely successful and gone down, in some cases come back up again.
Uh-huh.
Why, if there is the capacity, this might be a really naive question, and I appreciate that there are some differences, but if there is the capacity and the space and the workforce to build to do automobile style engineering,
mm-hmm.
Why can't some of that go towards high tech? Because I mean, essentially,
it's scale.
Scale.
It's scale.
It's scale.
There are no auto plants that are employing hundreds of thousands of people
and generating the numbers of cars equivalent to the number of iPhones, I assume.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and part of that is also the scale of what's produced. Like it takes a lot of room to produce a car. It doesn't take as much to produce an iPhone.
You know, and I've seen how it's made. I religiously watch.
I love that show.
Oh my God, I love that show.
I want Apple to have their own How It's Made channel. I would subscribe to Apple Music just for that. I'm going to just keep saying it until it's true.
Yeah, but I have a point here. There is the one episode dealt with I think making Rolls's
mm-hmm.
in the UK,
yeah.
And there is. It might not have been the Rolls Royce. It might have been a different high end, super expensive British car. But yep. My point is that there is lots of skill in Britain that could not just be like those cars just couldn't suddenly be made in China for the very same reason. The skill set to do what goes into those cars, especially in terms of the leather and the wood and things like that. That skill set is there in Britain.
Mm-hmm. Right, but
and it's the same kind of thing that we're facing right now. The skill set to do all the stuff that we need for large scale precision electronics assembly, that skill set is currently in China.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think part of that is I mean, it's the opposite of what we're talking about with the phones, like where you couldn't just all of a sudden haul that off to someplace else. So I think that comes out to be kind of interesting. I think that's going to have to do it for us for now, but I'm sure we will talk more about manufacturing in the future. Maybe even tomorrow after this will most likely come up during the earnings call. So make sure you keep an ear out for that. We will have loads of coverage of the earnings call over at MacObserver.com. And two of the people involved in that coverage are with me today. Thanks for coming by, Charlotte.
Thank you for having me.
And thanks for coming by, Brian.
Yep, thanks for having me. It was good to be here.
And I will talk to all of you tomorrow. I hope all of you have a happy, happy Monday and be excellent to each other.